Is that better?
Somebody else knows the report. Good evening, happy holidays. I'm Shannon. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 16th of 2009, and my home group is out at Lake of the Woods, the Living Serious Group, and I do have a sponsor. And you're right, it's like 6:03. That is an hour, but okay, we'll see how we do. Give you a little bit of background. I grew up in Northern Virginia, in Burke, not too terribly far from here, and I have an older brother who's 6 years older, and my parents have now been married for 53 years. And I grew up in basically what would be just your typical mom was a stay-at-home mom, had a brother, cat and a dog, you know, the whole thing. I had a very ordinary life, just run-of-the-mill, just what you'd see out of some book, you know, textbook. And so, you know, I just say that just as a little bit of background of, you know, that, it, well, you'll see. But anyway, so I guess the first time that I can remember that I was introduced to drinking, and my parents, neither one of my parents are alcoholics, by the way, and so when they, it was kind of the drinking that my dad would on the weekends. We had a townhouse, and this was back when you only had like one TV in your house, and it was in the basement. And so on the weekends, he got to go down and watch football, right, you know, downstairs, and he would get like a six-pack of Sturz beer, and we had a little refrigerator, and he'd put it in there, and he'd drink maybe two, three beers, maybe, and then, you know, the rest would sit there throughout the weekend. I remember, I was about maybe 9 or 10, and I remember going up to him and asking if I could have a sip of his beer, right? You know, because there's my dad, is drinking his beer, and I said, can I have a sip of your beer? And he, you know, being smart, thought, well, I'll give her a sip of the beer, and then it will cure her from ever wanting to drink again, right? So he did. He gave me a sip of the beer, and it cured me of ever drinking Stroh's beer. Ever. Ever again. So... But anyway, so time went on, and I guess I was about 14, and that seems to be kind of one of those ages that I hear a lot in this program at 13, 14. And my best friend at the time, she was the youngest of 6 children, and so they, since being older, most of them, a lot of them, and this was back when the drinking age was 18, so a lot of them could buy beer, and they would have or have whatever. And so I remember hanging out with her and drinking. Alcohol was just always around, and so being a girl, and you go to the parties, and, you know, it's like, oh, have a beer, have this, you know, and I remember drinking, and I remember, I never felt like I didn't fit in, and I never felt real awkward, but I remember just when I drank the beer for the first time and really drank, I remembered I felt good. I mean, I just remembered I really liked the way that it felt. It wasn't like all of a sudden I felt, you know, better, or that I just, it was like, ooh, that warm kind of just this great warming feeling, and I just really liked the way that it made me feel. And so that kind of just continued. You know, I never, like, you know, it was 14, 15, and I had the same best friend, and ironically, she never drank. Never drank. She still barely drinks. I think her husband still drinks maybe a glass of wine with her husband every once in a while, but she never drank. So as we got older, it became even better because she got her driver's license, and then she would drive everywhere. So I never drove. She always drove. She had the older siblings. We could always go to the parties where all the other kids were at, and there was always beer and whatever. And, you know, drugs are not a big part of my story. I mean, I can remember being a teenager and having people offer me pot, and I remember trying pot, but I didn't really like it. It made me feel slow and paranoid, and, you know, then you get the munchies, and then you have guilt about that, and, you know, so I remember not, but, you know, and this was back before pot was kind of the big thing, and, you know, Coke was out there a little bit, but we didn't have a lot of the stuff that people have that's out there now. So anyway, drugs are not a big part of my story. And so when we were juniors in high school, I remember this was the first time that I ever had experience with anything happening really bad with alcohol. My best friend and I, who didn't drink, we were out at a party, and her two of her older sisters, were actually going out, and they were leaving her house, and two of them were in the car, her two of her older sisters, and they were hit head-on by a drunk driver. And her one older sister was killed immediately. One sister walked away from the crash with nothing. I mean, just got up like as if there'd never been an accident. The other one was hit on impact. She was the driver, and it killed her immediately. And the gentleman who lived in their neighborhood, they were leaving their neighborhood, and he was you know, it's hard to remember now. He was probably in his 30s, but he had two young kids, and he was a father and just had gone out for happy hour and was coming home and hit the two of them and killed her. And so, but I remember feeling, I remember when we were at this party, my friend and I, and people saying, well, you need to go home, something's happened. You know, how bad could it be? Because bad things didn't happen. You know, I mean, that was the theory, is that bad things didn't happen. And so, of course, it was really bad when we found out. And that was one of the things I always felt really bad about, was that I felt later as if she should have been there sooner, but she stayed with me at this party, and we didn't get there. But, you know, her and I are still very, very good friends. And that was one of those things that in going through the steps that you kind of work through. But like I said, her and I are still very good friends. And the other thing about that whole situation was, is that I can remember not only that being the first experience with something bad happening with alcohol, but that I remember it was the first real act of complete forgiveness that I'd ever seen. And I can remember it to this day, because after he was, when he was going through his trial and they were going through sentencing for him, the man that hit them, I remember her mom had wanted nothing to do with it. She just wanted nothing to do with it. She just felt as if it just was not going to help her grief in any way, and she just had moved on at that point. And she had accepted that her daughter was gone and that she just needed to move on. And even though the rest of the family was like spinning in circles trying to, you know, figure out, you know, well, this guy's got to go away forever, and this guy, you know, she really saw it from, this was a man who had been their neighbor, lived in their neighbor and had little kids, and she would see his wife at the grocery store, and she just, you know, and I could have it totally wrong, and I could have seen it differently, and she may inside feel such hate for this person, but she never showed it. She never showed it, and she just had this forgiveness that I remember even being 17 and being in awe of the forgiveness that this woman had, and just, you know, needing to get over the grief that she had for her daughter. But anyway, so a couple years go by, and again, it's just very typical, very nothing real bad happens, nothing real good happens. I graduate from high school, and here was the thing is when it was time to go to college, my parents were great, and I had this older brother, and he was 6 years older, and I learned from experience through him in that when he went to college, he went to George Mason after he graduated, and he went to college for a semester, and he would get up and he'd go to school every day, and he'd come back, and then of course when his grades came out, he had failed every class. And my parents said, well, how did you fail? You were getting up and going to school. Like, how much work did you need to do? And of course he was golfing every day. He was getting up and leaving the house, but he was golfing. So the lesson that I learned was that my parents said, well, okay, well, now you need to go to Plan B because you can't live in the house if you're not going to school. And so he did join the Army. But the valuable point of the lesson was that he had to pay my parents back every penny. Every penny. And so for 6 years, that's rattling around in my head as I'm going through school. And then when it comes time for me to go to college, I pretty much knew at that point that I really just wanted to party. I mean, I really did. And it wasn't so much partying. It was just that I just wanted to be on my own. I wanted to do what I wanted to do. But I also knew that I couldn't live at home if I didn't, you know, have a job or this. And so I figured I was going to go to Washington Business School and I was going to become a secretary because I'd always wanted to be a secretary. I'd always wanted to work in an office and, you know, just kind of that kind of thing. And so I did. I went to Washington Business School and I did very well. And it was a 1 year, and I knew that I needed to do well because I knew I needed to get a good job. And I needed to be on my own, and I did. So I got a job at 19, and my first full-time job was working for a construction company. And ironically, again, I had grown up around the construction industry. My dad has been in the construction industry forever. My uncles, my cousins, my brother. You know, so I ended up, and it just so happened to be one of the interviews that they sent me on. And so I go, and it was in Old Town Alexandria. And I don't know if anybody's familiar with Old Town Alexandria, but if you're 19, it is a really fun place to go. It is really, really fun. And I had this great job. It was only like, you know, it really could have been within walking distance from, you know, right downtown, you know, Old Town. And you could just run the strip and go to all the pubs. And it was great because I've never been a big, like the club type person, like with all the lights and the dance and the huge places where you can't hear each other. Like the pub atmosphere has always been perfect for me. So this was just like, you could just do, and I remember, you know, one of the best St. Patrick's days, and I'm not to glorify it, but it was really, really fun. We started out, it was like on a Saturday, and we started out about noon and just walked that whole strip and paid for it for days later. But anyway, you know, and this was back in the day when, you know, I'm young. And so, of course, even though now I'm working and I'm going to happy hour every day, I'm getting up and going to work every day. So it's okay. And I'm functioning and nobody's complaining about, you know, I'm obviously doing a good job. And then, of course, then you get your Friday lunches that come in, you know, your martini lunches that sneak their way in there. And but it was really fun. But and the other thing that I remember about when I worked at this place was I had this boss, and it was funny because he was he had started out in the company years before me. He had actually started out as a secretary for the president of the company because the president of the company's wife would not, he had to travel a lot. So the president of the company's wife would not allow him to have a female secretary. So my boss became his secretary. Well, years later now he's worked his way up to vice president and he's now my boss. I remember thinking he was so old. He was like 36. And I remember thinking, oh, he's so old, you know? And anyway, but he used to go drink with us every once in a while. But he was one of those normal people that, you know, he would drink a couple beers or he'd drink on the weekends. And then he had his family and the whole thing. And I can remember after I'd been working there for maybe 8 or 9 months, I remember sitting in his office and he said something to me. He was like, so did you go out to happy hour again last night? And I said, yeah. I said, I go to happy hour every night, you know? And he looked at me and I remember he said, Shannon, you got to be careful of your liver. And I remember thinking, that is the strangest thing to say to someone. Like, seriously, like, who talks about your internal organs? Like, I mean, it's like, you know, I can see maybe, you know, you got to be careful you don't drink and drive, or you got to be careful that, you know, but really, I mean, like, and that's exactly what he said. But see, it's one of those things that now looking back, it clicked, it registered in my head, and I never forgot it. I never forgot it. But I remember thinking, that's just so strange. What does drinking have to do with my liver? Like, it hadn't even occurred to me that there could be any downfall health-wise to drinking because I didn't grow up around, you know, I didn't have a lot of that where I saw people, you know, that had cirrhosis or people that, you know, I didn't have that. So for me, hadn't even thought about that it could physically start to affect you. So a little time goes on, and this was during the late 80s, early 90s, and so this was when the first of, I don't know how many recessions hit, and anyway, with the construction industry, and so everybody started getting laid off, and I was one of the ones that got laid off, and so I actually got I was looking for a job and being young and single, and, you know, I thought, hey, I'll go work in a bar. I'll work as a waitress. It'll be great. And I did, and I went to work. I had a girlfriend, actually my friend, that didn't drink, worked in a sports bar, and she said, hey, come on, well, I'll get you a job here at Champions Champions in Tyson's Corner. And I said, oh, great. So I went, and again, great place to be if you like to drink, because, you know, I would work real hard, and then you'd get off, and then you'd sit there at the bar and drink with everybody else, and when you going on your off days, you got pretty much free drinks and met a lot of people. And I actually met what is – I call my first husband because that's what he was. So I guess technically I got to call him that. But I kind of like to call it my tester marriage, you know. But anyway, I mean, you know, we got to test the waters, make sure that we really want to get in there the second time. But so that's where I met him at Champions. And, anyway, we met, and about a week after we met, though, he started going to school to get his master's in Frostburg, Maryland. And so for the whole time we dated, we had a long-distance relationship. We were 3 hours apart, and we saw each other on the weekends, maybe every other weekend. And it was great because when you see somebody 1 or 2 days a week or every, you know, it's great. I mean, because it's not real life. I mean, it's not... You know, it's not. And I remember when we were getting close to being engaged, I actually thought we should live together. And my dad said, if you live with him before you get married, I will not pay for a wedding. Well, I was the girl that wanted the big wedding and wanted the dress and wanted the, so we didn't live together. And he proposed and we got married and it was the big wedding and it was great. And the first time that we had ever spent, I think, more than 3 consecutive days together was after we got married. Yeah. Yeah. And it's like nobody, you know, it's like, well, you didn't tell me you were like this. And well, you didn't tell me you were like this. And well, you didn't tell me, you know, and I remember it was like I'd come home from work and he'd want to go jogging or he'd want to go and I wanted to drink. I mean, I had gone to work all day long. So this was the time when you drank. You don't go jog, or you don't go, you know. And but here's the thing. See, this is how, like, our brain, we can convince ourselves and see things through our rose-colored glasses, because he was getting his master's in exercise physiology. And I didn't think that he'd want to work out every day. Like, I don't know where that didn't get click in my head that me wanting to drink every day was not going to coincide with his health issues. So, anyway, we've been together for a while, and he was actually the only person, well, until the end, that actually called me out on my drinking, and he was right. But being in that, I didn't come from a divorced home, and I didn't, you know, I felt like, okay, well, we have to make, okay, so what do you want to do? And he asked me if I'd go to AA, and I said, sure. I didn't know anything about it. And at the time, I knew that I probably drank too much because I like to drink every day. But it wasn't a problem. I got up and I went to work. I paid my bills. I never didn't have any DWIs. I never fought with anybody. I wasn't combative. You know, so what was the problem? So I remember I told him I'd go, and we went to this. It was in Alexandria, and it was or Annandale, Alexandria. Anyway, it was down in Northern Virginia, and it was this big, huge, gigantic church. And this was, you know, what, like the early 90s. And I remember I got, like, really, really super dressed up, like I was going to church. Like, I mean, it was just, you know, like, really or a job interview or something, thinking, you know, that everybody was going to be, you know, I didn't think people would be in jeans. I don't know what I was thinking. Obviously, I had no concept of what an AA meeting was. So we go, and we go to this huge church, and we go back around, and this is when everybody still smoked. And I remember going in, and I remember that there was the smokers in there, and it was a speakers meeting, and I can't remember who the speaker was. I don't remember if it was a man or a woman. I don't remember anything that they said. I remember everybody was very nice, of course, and I remember people came up, and I remember they handed me literature. I think I threw it away the next day. I remember everybody was very nice, but I remember when they came to the point, and this I remember clear as a bell. I can't remember who spoke, but I remember that they said, is there anybody that's here for their first time like we do, or anybody here? And I didn't say anything, and I just sat there, and I didn't say a word, because I wasn't an alcoholic. So why would I say that? Right? Because I'm not an alcoholic. I was there because this person wanted me to go. So I'm doing the right thing by being here with this person because he wants me to go, but I'm not an alcoholic. So I'm not going to stand in front of these people I don't know and say I'm an alcoholic. And so I remember we left, and he was furious with me. He was so upset and just had this feeling like that I just wasn't really willing to do what it took. And I, you know, and I was willing to do what it took, but I wasn't willing to say I was an alcoholic because I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. There was a difference between someone that you thought, you know, maybe I drink too much, but I can control it. I can get under control, but I'm not an alcoholic. Anyway, that relationship ended shortly after that and pretty quickly. And I remember one of the things, and I remember thinking this, is that well, now I can just go back to drinking the way I want to drink. I mean, now I don't have to answer to him, and I don't have to answer to my parents because I pay my own bill, you know. So now I can just drink how I want to drink. And I also remember, and this is the sickness of the disease, is that I can remember thinking in my head, planning out that the next person that I dated, you know, it wasn't like he'd have to have a car or he'd have to have a job or he'd have to, you know, be sane or anything like that. It was that this is serious. I remember thinking is that he had to drink at least as much as I did. He had to drink. He had to at least be able to keep up with me. He had to drink at least as much as I did. He could drink more, but he had to drink at least as much. And, I mean, that's the sickness, is that when you're not even, like, you're, like, leaving one relationship before you even get to the next one, it's, like, on the top of your checklist is, you know, is that he has to drink as much as you do. But I figured that that was going to alleviate any of the problems that I had in this last relationship from occurring again. But this is the sickness. So, anyway, so little time goes on, and then I meet somebody else who does drink just as much as I do. And luckily enough, he was actually a friend of the family, so I knew a lot about him already. And he drank just as much as I did. And he turned out to be my second husband, technically, but you know, the real husband, you know, the real marriage or whatever. But he and we did. We drank. We both worked, but we would drink from the minute we would get home until the minute we would go to sleep. You know, and I was never a blackout drinker. I would drink until I went to sleep. And I always remember going, I mean, I can even remember, like, I always would wake up and remember what was the last thing on TV before I went to, you know. I can remember I blacked out maybe 2-3 times that I'm pretty sure that I had a blackout. But, you know, but over a span of 25 years, I wouldn't really consider that a blackout drinker. So, but we would drink from the minute we would get home until the minute we go to sleep. And that was just every single day. And when we, on the weekends, it would be around noon. We would, you know, start a pop open a beer or something. And, but again, we both worked. We both were paying our bills. We didn't fight with people. You know, everything was getting done. So we didn't have a problem. And, little time goes on, and we get pregnant with my first son. And of course, then again, as women, some of you may know that because I was able to not drink for 9 months, I must not be an alcoholic. Well, because I was an alcoholic, I wouldn't be able to just automatically not drink for 9 months. So, but here's another thing about the sickness of the way that our thinking works is that here I am pregnant with my first child, okay, and I'm 29 years old, and they want to throw me a shower, right? And women, it's like we're like, oh, the baby, the first baby, and it's like have the baby shower and get all the good stuff, and like, and we just nest, and it's like we got to get all the clothes and everything's got to be perfect, and we have to have everything just absolutely perfectly so, and that was all fine and good, but I was not going to have a party with all of my family and friends where I couldn't drink. So I had my baby shower after my son was born. I planned my baby shower after 2 months, when my son was 2 months old. I planned it. I said, this is great. I want the big baby shower. Because I was like, when they're brand new, what do you need? I mean, really, you need some diapers. You need a couple things of clothes, maybe a blanket and a crib. But you don't need, like, all that other good stuff, right? You can get that later. And so, no, I didn't. So here was the thing is that I had this party, and I planned it with my cousin, and she was throwing me the baby shower, and but we were trying to, you know, because people thought it was odd. Some people thought it was odd that we didn't have the baby shower before the baby was born. But yeah, it's odd. Even Sam's like, it's odd. Okay. I get, you know, now I get it. See, now I get it. But here's the thing is, so I heard about this great thing in Britain or England where they do these parties after the baby's born. Okay, and people come, and they have their shower beforehand. But they also have a party after the baby's born, and it's called a sip and see, where people come and they sip tea and they see the baby, right? This is after the baby's born. I thought, that's perfect. That's what I did. And we called it a chug and hug. I kid you not. We had flyers thrown up with my picture of these flyers. I wish I had one. Okay, because it was me holding my brand new son, right? Come to the chug and hug. I mean, how ridiculous is that? It was ridiculous. It was, but again, I thought it was genius. I thought it was great planning. I thought it was creative. I thought, you know, and I am still a little bit amazed that it hasn't caught on, you know, but it hasn't. So, because the majority of people are not like us, thank God. But anyway. So have the, and of course, and then I remember being at the hospital, and of course I'm thinking that you couldn't drink at the hospital, but when my husband came in and he had a bottle of champagne, and the nurses didn't say, well, you can't drink them here, this is a hospital. When they didn't say anything, this was perfect planning. I kept that back in back in my little reservoir for the next child. So have my son. Now, again, everything goes right back to normal. Now I'm a stay-at-home mom, though, so now I can start drinking at noon instead of waiting until 5 or 6. Now I can drink at noon every day, you know. And I had this great little thing where I felt like if on the days when I couldn't get enough done or whatever the case may be, and if as long as we had this patch of carpet right when you walked in the front door, and I knew Mark would usually call him right before he left on his way home or whatever, and I knew that if I had something cooking in the oven, and I had that patch of carpet vacuumed right when he walked in. So it's like, you know, you open the door and there's that freshly vacuumed carpet right there. It's like it gives you this immediate thing of smelling something cooking and clean carpet that's just been vacuumed. It's like all of a sudden it's like the blinders go on and everything else can be a mess. But seriously, it works. But and also, the minute he would walk across that thing of carpet, there would be a drink waiting for him. So that was the kicker. And the minute that he started drinking, it didn't matter. So I had this all, you know, planned out. So anyway, 4 years later, we have my second son, and again, everything's just going along. Nobody's getting in trouble. We were both always home drinkers, so there was never any, you know, we neither of us had any problems with. We like to drink at home. So 4 years later, my second son comes, but I am a better planner this time. I know that I can drink in the hospital after the baby comes, and so I have the minis packed in my suitcase for when I go in to have my second son, okay? Now, I'm not crazy. I didn't breastfeed. I wouldn't do that to my child. I have, you know, I'm responsible. So, you know, I immediately said, no, that's not going to work for me because that would have been irresponsible to drink and breastfeed, as we all know. So I didn't because that would be bad. So I did not. So anyway, so of course now I have it. And so I am in the hospital. And of course I think that, you know, I'm going to be this cheap date, and it doesn't work that way. And I think I've gone 9 months and it doesn't work that way. And so anyway, but of course I have the minis and I drink, and anyway, go home, same thing. 3 years later, again, everything's just gone along just the same as it always has. And nobody's getting in trouble. Nobody's, you know, he works. I'm a stay-at-home mom. The house is going fine. Bills are getting paid. Everybody's happy. 3 years later, my third son comes along, and now I've really, really, really got it planned. And that now I have my overnight bag or my hospital bag packed a month before, and the first thing that goes in is the minis. It's not even like I throw them in like with the second one. The first thing I pack is the minis. And I kid you not, over a period of a month, and this is the, here I am, I've gone 8 months now without drinking, okay, with my third, now, you know, because I'm pregnant, I've got 8 months, and here I am just absolutely every day counting them, repacking them, packing them in different spots, because should they all be together? Because what if my bag, you know, it was like, it was just this game. And again, I think it's planning. It's the insanity of this disease. It had completely taken hold of me in that last month that I was not counting the days my baby was born. I was counting the days until I could pop open those minis. You know, and it's like, you guys seen the movie Flight? Have you seen the movie Flight? Okay, you know when he grabs that mini at the end? You know what I'm talking about? It's up there. And it's like before he even cracked that thing open, you can hear those little pins go, you know, around the bottle. Oh, my God. And it was like, I remember seeing that movie thinking, I didn't hope I didn't ruin it for anybody. I won't tell you the end if you haven't seen the movie. But anyway, so I have this bag packed, and I've got, I kid you not, at least 30 minis, vodka minis, going to the hospital for 2 days. It's not like I had a C-section. I wasn't in there for a week, okay? I was going in for two. I'm not kidding you. 30 minis packed in my purse and all these different ones. And I remember he came very quickly. My son, they actually called him the nine-minute mom. I got to the hospital at 1:55 in the morning. He was born at 2:04 in the morning. And, yeah, it was – and I didn't have my first contraction until 12:15. So we barely made it to the hospital, and then – so it was very quick, and he came out, and then it's like everybody was there, and then everybody left, and so then I'm here, and I'm in this room and with this baby, and I'm kind of exhausted and kind of anxious, and my body's just like been through like the ringer. But I remember thinking, okay, now I can have all my minis, right? This is going to be great. This is going to be so great. And I can remember that it was, I remember feeling like this time I'm going to get that high. This time I'm going to get like that warm feeling that you got when you were 14 and you have that, and you just like your whole body just gets warm from head to toe and all tingly and you're good. And I thought this time I know it's going to happen. I know it's going to happen. And I get this mini, and I just, and at first I think, should I sip it? Should I just take a little bit? Nah, I just down the whole thing, right? Because that's really going to do it. I know it's going to give me that feeling I've been looking for. Down the whole thing, and here I am. I'm sitting in this hospital bed, and I have my son, he's sitting on my legs. I have my legs up, and he's sitting on my legs, and his little face is right there looking at me, and he's all bundled up, and he's just this little perfect little child. And I'm sitting here looking at him, and I wait. Nothing. And here's the thing that gets me is that even then, I knew that as I'm looking at this perfect little face, I'm feeling complete and total disappointment. I'm so disappointed. I'm so disappointed. And I remember feeling like, how can I not feel disappointed? Because I immediately felt bad. Because here I am looking at this perfect child that I just gave birth to. And I'm feeling disappointed because I did not get the buzz that I so rightly deserved. After being good for 9 months, I deserved it. And I just remember looking at that little face, and just, it was horrible. It was a horrible, horrible, horrible feeling, because then it's like trying to fight to feel really happy about just being a mom, but I couldn't, so then it was just, well, let's just drink till you get drunk, you know, I mean, then, and so I proceeded to go through all of the minis, but you know what, the doctors didn't notice, nobody noticed, so I thought again, I'm not an alcoholic, because surely somebody would have noticed by now if I can manage to, you know, nobody noticed, and everything's good, so go home. Again, the life, now we've had 3 kids, and we've been married, my husband and I have been married for about 10 years, and we're just ready to coast, you know, as we called it. We're like, okay, everything's good, we just need to coast, let's just live our lives and go along and have everything be good. And when our youngest son was 7 months old, in October of that year, my husband was diagnosed with ALS, which is Lou Gehrig's disease, if anybody knows. And that was, you know, you live your life thinking that you know how you're going to handle things. And you live your life thinking, well, if that was to ever be my case, I know how I would handle it. And you have no idea You have no idea how you're going to handle something until you're right in the midst of it. And it was like, I just remember when they diagnosed him, it was as if it was when he was living and then when he began dying. And it just was that quick. And I am someone who, when I am under stress or anxiety or anything like that, and I didn't know this till later in life because, like I said, growing up, I had this pretty normal, average life. I just shut down. I don't eat. I don't sleep. I start to just shut down. And so that was when the alcoholism really, really could physically take its toll because I barely ate and I barely slept and the anxiety got worse and the stress got worse and I just drank. And so it came to a point when I was just drinking 24/7. I was just drinking. And when you get to a point when you're not eating and that's all your body, it's very quickly, and it's like we talk about that line, and I don't know when I crossed over to being that person that could function and not being the person that can function, but it happens very quickly. And one minute you can get up and take a shower and go to the store and not shake and not throw up, and then the next minute you know you can't. I mean, you just can't. And, of course, I go to the doctors because, and of course, being that, you know, here my husband is dying and I have these three children, everybody feels so sorry for me. And the doctor's like, oh, well, you just have stress. You can take anxiety medicine. And did it. But of course, on every bottle, what does it say? Do not take with alcohol. But who's going to follow that? I mean, right? So, but I'm convinced that my stress and everything will get better if I can just drink. I'm convinced that it just, you know, it'll get better. And so, you know, it never occurs to me until later that everything gets worse when we drink. Stress gets worse. Anxiety gets worse, depression gets worse. I mean, we know that now, but everything just gets worse. So I became a very, very, very sick person. And so in our house were two very, very sick people. And I was to the point where towards the end of my drinking, and this happened for about 2 years, and it consistently got worse. And my parents live right across the street from us. Like, literally, like, our driveways line up. And it's interesting because when we built the house, my husband was a builder, and we built the house, and we did all these things, you know, like, put in handy, you know, to make things handicap accessible because, of course, we were figuring that eventually my parents would need it. Well, that's God doing for us what we cannot do. That was a definite because we absolutely, he placed me across the street from my parents. There's no doubt. I mean, that was a God thing. And I became very sick to, I was yellow from head to toe. I was greenish yellow. My eyes were yellow. I threw up all the time. I couldn't eat. I would get minimal sleep. I shook uncontrollably all the time. I would bruise. The first year when I came into the program, that first summer, I never wore shorts. I wore jeans because I had bruises. Because anything that I would touch, I would just bruise. And in fact, I think there's somebody sitting back there that actually thought my husband beat me before we knew that my husband had ALS. I was like, oh, that poor girl, she's beaten by her husband, that poor girl, because I just bruised. And my hair was falling out, and what was left of it was very thin and very frizzy. I was very thin, but I was abnormally thin. It was I could struggle to stand up straight because I just always felt like I was going to fall over. I threw up all the time, and I would, when I would get some sleep, I would get maybe, if I was lucky, maybe 2 hours or so, and then the shaking would wake me up to where, and by this point, the jig was up. By this point, everybody was on to me. I mean, you know, you turn green, people start to, they're going to put two and two together. So now, everybody's watching me like a hawk. So now I've got my my booze, and I stash it in my closet, okay, and I stash it underneath my clothes, the hanging clothes, and so I would wake up after a couple hours of sleep from shaking so badly, and I would go into my closet, and I would sit on my knees, and I would take a shot glass, and I'd have a Coke or something, and I'd take a shot, and I would take the first shot really quick, and I would pray that I could count to 10. Because if I could count to 10 without immediately throwing up, then I could take the second shot. And if I could take the second shot, I knew that I could maybe get about 45 minutes of rest. Like, the shaking would stop just enough. And this was this horrible cycle that continued every day for a long time. And it got to a point where, I mean, I was throwing up in my closet. I threw away so much of my clothes because you just don't care. And you get to a point when you throw up in something, you know you're going to throw up. You know you're not going to make it to the bathroom. So you grab a shirt or a sweater and you throw up in it and you just bundle it up and you just throw it away. I mean, it's just a disgusting behavior that we get to. And at that point, not only can we not do anything physically about it, we don't really care. We just want to get from one moment to the next to the next. And I was very, very, very sick. And in fact, when the jig was up, my mom took me to the doctor, and they did my blood work, and my liver enzymes, the normal is 0.02 to 1, and mine was at 17. And she was amazed that I didn't have cirrhosis, but I didn't. And so now that I'm at this point of the drinking, as I can remember, at one point I was at my parents' house, and my parents said, we have to do something. And so I actually detoxed at my parents' house, and because I knew they were going to send me away. They were going to send me to a rehab, and I was terrified because I still thought the rehabs were like one flew over the cuckoo's nest. I really did. I thought they were going to lock me up, and I'm never going to see my kids. I'm never going to get out, and it's going to be horrible. My family's not going to be able to visit me. I mean, I really, really honestly believe that. And so I said, okay, so I went to my parents' house, and at this point, my brother-in-law has moved in to help take care of my husband. And my parents and my brother-in-law basically are taking care of my children. I mean, because I can't take care of myself at this point. So thank God for them that they were doing that. But so I go to my parents' house to detox for 3 days. And, one of the things I'm so grateful for is that I'm so grateful that I had no idea at the time how bad it was going to be and how sick it was going to be. Because knowing what I know now, I don't think I could do it again. I don't think I could go through those 3 days again. And after the three, I mean, it was just horrible. It was just sick and throwing up and shaking and just the pain from head to toe and the itching. I don't know if anybody else had itching, but I just itched uncontrollably. It just itched so bad. My skin just felt like, and it was a mess. And so, but after 3 days, I was so weak and I couldn't keep anything down. And I remember my parents finally said that I asked them if I could go home and take a shower. And again, this is right across the street. And I got to the door of my parents' house. I'm getting ready to walk across the street in the middle of the day. And I turned to my dad and I said, Dad, I said, will you watch me walk across the street? Because I honestly did not think I could make it. I honestly did not think, as a 39-year-old woman, that I was strong enough to walk from my parents' house to my house. I thought I was going to collapse. I really did. I was that sick and felt that horrible. I really just thought I was just going to collapse and die right there walking across the street. And I didn't. And now that I've gone through this, and again, this is not knowing what I know now, and of course knowing about seizures and all the horrible things that could have gone wrong, I don't recommend ever detoxing at home if you're in that bad of shape, but it worked out for me like it did, and luckily nothing bad happened. But so here's the thing. So here's another one of the God moments is that my mom says she calls the AA hotline, and she figures that now that I've gone through this point that maybe I'll go to AA. And I said, I said I would. At this point I wasn't arguing with anybody. And so she calls up the AA hotline, and this woman answers the phone, and my mom starts talking to her, and they get in this conversation. She's like, well, my daughter this, and da-da-da. And there's this pause in the conversation, and this woman on the other line that answered the AA hotline said, my mom's name is Dee, and she said, Dee, is this you? Is this Dee? Is this Dee Flood from out at? And my mom said, yes. And she broke her anonymity to my mother. This is a woman that my mother had known for years. It did not know she was in the program. Had no idea. And this is one of those God moments, because anybody could have answered that phone. Anybody could have answered this phone. And she said, Dee, tell her there's a meeting right there at Lake of the Woods. Tell her to go tonight. She will be okay. She will be okay. And I say it was a God moment because it immediately made that whole conversation become very familiar. It was a conversation with someone that was trusted. And when she said she'll be okay, it was like, if she said it, of course I will. And I went, to my first AA meeting, and so now we're to the point, I guess, what happened. I go to my first AA meeting, and I'm a mess, I'm sure, and there's a few people in this room that actually were there at my first AA meeting, and they're still here to see me today. I was a mess, and I went in, and here was the thing, is that I was so sick, I really did not think that I could ever be well. I really did not believe I could ever be well again. And that was okay. I was willing to be sick and white-knuckle it my entire life. I just didn't want to die. I just didn't want to die. I knew my husband was dying, and I had three boys. And I could run it through, like we say, play the tape to the end. And I could actually see my oldest son as a teenager having a conversation with people saying, yeah, my dad died of ALS when I was 9, and my mom drank herself to death 6 months later. I could see that conversation. And I didn't care how sick I had to be. I just wanted to be there for my kids. And so I came, And we say keep coming back, but what was weird was that I kept coming back because, ironically, when I was in the AA meetings, it was the only place that my drinking wasn't the big deal. When I was at home, my drinking was a huge deal. I came to meetings, and it was not like the pink elephant in the room. The big white light wasn't shining right on me, you know. I could come, and I felt safe. And so that initially was what kept me coming back, was just because I felt like I can come here, and you all don't want to go, are you drinking, are you drinking? And, you know, and that, when I look back on that, that's why now I still think that I don't care what brings you into these rooms. Just stay. Just stay long enough. Because, see, I stayed long enough for the miracle to happen. And before I knew it, I could sleep through the night. Before I knew it, I could actually eat a meal. Now, this took a while. And I had been in the program for about 2.5 months, almost 3 months, and when my husband passed away. And I was making, I was in the kitchen. My husband was at home at this point, and I was making pancakes with my 3 sons. And I hadn't made pancakes in, I don't even know how long. I mean, maybe ever. I mean, I can't even remember. Homemade pancakes. And I decided we got the chocolate chips out, and we got this, and we're making all these pancakes. And it's this beautiful, beautiful October morning. It's absolutely gorgeous outside. And my oldest son, at the point, he realized that Mark had stopped breathing. And we went over, and we knew he was close. And he passed away. But my point of this is that even though I had only been in almost 3 months, I had been in just long enough that I was able to maintain sanity that day with my kids. And that day went very, very smoothly. And being that it is a day that my children, at least my oldest, will never forget. And that day alone, I can never repay this program for giving me that day. That important day that my children will never forget, the day that their father passed away, and that I was able to hold it together and be present and be there for them. That program, this program gave me that day completely. So after he passed away, though, I completely just really threw myself into this program, because prior to that, I still had to be home quite a bit because he could never be left alone. And so after that, I think maybe a week into it, I was there, and a very good friend who's still a very good friend of mine said, hey, we go to dinner on Monday nights before the Monday night meeting. Why don't you come join us? And I remember thinking, no, 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 I can't. And then I remember thinking, why not? And I got involved, and I went, and I started going to dinner with this fabulous group of people before my home group meeting. And that was where I found my sponsor. I didn't get my sponsor until I was about 5.5 months into the program. I know that people say, you know, do 90 and 90 and get a sponsor in this, and that's not the way that my program worked, but I think in the beginning, I think people were just so happy to see me come back that I hadn't. I mean, you know, I think there was people in my home group that were just like, wow, she is back again. Like, that's just enough. Like, she's trying, she's here, she didn't kill. I mean, really, it was just like, I mean, I had a guy that came to the meeting, and he said to somebody, I think it's in this room, he said, because I looked so bad, that he said, he goes, I don't know if that girl hasn't stopped drinking, but if she hasn't, she has got to stop today. I mean, that's how bad I looked. And so I kept coming back, and after about 5.5 months, I got a sponsor. And at this point, I was going to meetings. I mean, I faithfully went to my three ones there's three out of Lake of the Woods, and I didn't miss one of those. And I got connected with people in the program. I got my sponsor. I started working the steps. You know, I did the program the way that it was suggested to do it, you know. I started doing service work. I remember that I was about 4 months in, and somebody said, hey, we need a coffee maker for Wednesday night. And I remember thinking, I don't think I can do that. Like, I mean, I don't know why, but I just thought, really, you're going to give me you know, as we all do. Like, and being a coffee maker, especially when you're new in this program, it's great. I mean, and then we go on, and then we get demoted, and we become a coffee maker again, and it's great again, you know. And it's a great program where you can get demoted constantly, and it's always a blessing, you know. But I you know, and then it was funny was, and here's the other thing, is that after I'd been in the program for about a year, I remember I was cleaning out my attic, and I don't even know what I was looking for. It was during the summer. And again, I've been programmed about a year now, and I'm pulling out all this stuff. And in the back of my attic space, there's these two garbage bags, and I don't know what's in them. I pull them out, and in them is empty half gallons of vodka, filled. Two garbage bags, two full-size garbage bags, completely filled with empties. I don't know at what point they, because that's what I, at the end of my drinking, I was going to the liquor store. I would manage to drive to the liquor store every other day and get 2 half gallons and 2 minis, because the minis were to get me from the liquor store back home, because to open up a half gallon to drink like that would have been ridiculous. So I needed the minis to get me home because that was the responsible thing, was to drink the minis because it would have been ridiculous to drink out of the half gallon. So, but I find these trash bags, and I remember my immediate instinct was, oh my God, I got to get rid of them. Like, here's these two trash bags with all of these empty half gallons, and I think, oh my God, I got to hide it. Like, I got to, you know, I've been sober a year, and I'm like, I got to hide it. And I knew there was somebody coming over from the program, and I thought, you know what? No, I'm leaving them right here. And he walks up the stairs, and I just have these tears in my eyes. Like, and he's like, what? And I go, and I just showed them to him, and he was like, are they all empty? And I was like, yeah, they're empty. They're empty. And I'm still like with tears in my eyes. I remember he looked at me and he said, well, I'm confused. Did you not think you drank that much? And I was like, no. But again, it's only something that another alcoholic can understand. It wasn't like, oh my God, you drank that. It was like, you knew at this point that you drank that much. And so then it was like I could throw them away and I could be done with it. But, you know, it's like those little reminders just, you know, would creep, those nice reminders would creep in. Like, you know, it was a really bad place. And why I hid them way back in the, I mean, it was just the insanity of all of that is just the lengths we go to hide empty half gallons in the back of the attic space instead of putting them in the back of the truck and dropping them off at the neighbor's house or something, you know. On trash day. But anyway, you know, it's just these insane lengths that we go to. So anyway, now, like I said, I stayed long enough for the miracle to happen. And once I started to get well, which I never, ever, ever thought I would be well, it was just amazing. It was just amazing. And it's like every day has gotten better. And, you know, like I said, and I still do what the program suggests. I believe that this program has set out to be followed the way the people before us have followed it. I'm a firm believer in service work. I'm a firm believer. I have held a service position at least one since I had that coffee position at 4 months. I've had at least one. I'm doing some service work at the district level. I happen to love it. I know that's not for everybody, but there's plenty of service positions. And, you know, like I said, when I had that one day on the day that my husband passed away, this program gave me, I can do service work from now until the day I die. I could never repay this program. I could never, ever repay this program. I have this incredible life today. It's just an amazing life. And I still have a sponsor. I still go to regular meetings. I have a minimum amount of meetings that I know I need to go to. My minimum is three for me. If I can get to more, great. If I get to less, I start to get a little squirrely. I don't feel like drinking, but I can tell I start to get a little squirrely in my head. You know, I talk to other alcoholics on a regular basis. You know, I stay connected with people in this program. You know, I believe that the fellowship of this program is one of our biggest assets. I believe that if we're inside of this program and we are connected with other members of Alcoholics Anonymous, it is the best place for us to be. It's the safest place for us to be. We start getting on the outside, just my opinion, it's a scary place to be for an alcoholic. I think we need to be on the inside and let people know what you're doing. Have your home group. Have people that you know that if you don't show up or you start acting weird, I'll have people that if I'm off, they will call me after a meeting and they'll say, are you okay? You sounded a little, and I never take offense to it because I need people to check me. You know, I need people to do my checks and balances for me because as alcoholics, if we left in our own head, we don't think right. We've proven that we're dangerous to ourselves, left in our own head for too long. You know, so the program has been a great thing. And I know I'm getting to my, well, that's not good, only 10 minutes left. But, here's a few things is that, you know, when I look at my life and I look at 4 years and we talk about what happened and what it's like now and, you know, the holidays are great. And I was thinking today, I was thinking about 4 years ago and it was right after Mark had passed away and I'd been in the program for about 4 months and it was when I just really started feeling better. I remember this month was the month that I actually moved back into my house and was sleeping at my house because I'd been staying at my parents' house, which is right across the street. But we all moved back because my son actually finally said, my oldest, he said, when are we going to go back home? You know, it's right across the street. Are we selling our house? And I said, no. So 4 years ago today, I was just coming back into the house. And I remember being so excited for the holidays, but very nervous. And I remember being very excited for New Year's because I was very looking forward to 2010 because even though 2009 I had gotten sober, it had been a very rough year. And I just remember believing that as long as I stayed sober, 2010 was going to be a good year. I just knew it, and it was. And they've consistently gotten better, you know. And so 4 years ago, I was very unsure about the holidays. 4 years ago, when I came into the program, my parents never left the house. They never left the house at the same time. together because they were so afraid something was going to happen. You know, so they wouldn't even go to the store at the same time because they knew that somebody had to be there. You know, and now 4 years later, they travel all the time. I can't keep them home. You know, I really can't. I think they went to 10 countries last year. I mean, they went to Egypt and Israel in a very bad time, which, you know, luckily, you know, I had a very good support system, you know, to get me through that one. But no, they're traveling constantly. You know, 4 years ago, my son who was 9, who lived in this house that was, they all three lived in this house, but he remembers the most. And he lived in this house where at one point he went to my mother and he asked my mother if I was dying of the same thing his dad had. My 9-year-old son believed both of his parents had Lou Gehrig's disease. That's how sick I was. And I allowed him to live in that for a while before I got well. He believed we were dying. And we were. We were both dying. I was just dying of something different. You know, and now he's 13 years old, and he got his braces off on Monday, and he can't stop smiling this week. And for a 13-year-old, that is an amazing feat, you know. And, you know, and my all three of my boys are just, they're doing amazing, you know. And 4 years ago, I after I lost Mark, I really, you know, we believe that we don't deserve things. You know, we go through periods, especially when we're new in recovery or when we're drinking, that we believe that we don't deserve to be happy. We don't deserve things. And, you know, and when I was married to Mark, Mark loved me as much as I believed that he could. I mean, and he was a wonderful husband. And he deserved more of me in the end. He deserved for me in the end to be the kind of wife that he had been a husband to me, and I wasn't there. And I failed him, and I failed him miserably in the end. And we believe that may be our only shot at love because that's all that we deserve. But, you know, the miracle of this program is that that's not the case. And, you know, and I have an incredible person in my life, you know, today that we have a great love, and it's a great relationship. And one of the best things about it is that we're both in the program, and people, you know, have their different opinions of people getting involved, the people with the program. But it's great because I come home to the program every day, you know, and we both know that our sobriety comes first. We have that mutual respect. I don't have to ever explain to him that I need to call my sponsor. I don't ever have to explain to him that I need to get an extra meeting in, you know. I mean, and he doesn't have to do the same thing for me. I don't work his program. He doesn't work mine. But we both know that our sobriety absolutely comes first. And to have that respect and that love for being sober together is a really, really, really good foundation for a relationship. You know, I have incredible friends today. I know because when I went through what I went through before, I know who showed up. I know who called when Mark was sick. I know the people that were really there. And today I know the people that, if I'm sick, will drop off chicken noodle soup in my house. You know, I know the people that will call me. I know the people, these poor home group people, they have heard me talk more than good knows. And here they are out here after Thanksgiving driving out here. I mean, it's crazy. But, you know, I mean, we know that we're there for each other. We have, you know, and that's one of the good things about having a home group. It's an incredible light, and it's all by the grace of God and thanks to this program. And I'm going to close here with just a real quick story that I always close with. So you people that have heard it before, you've heard it before. But when I was 2 years sober, when I picked up my 2-year chip, there was a gentleman that he comes to our home group. He doesn't come as much as often anymore, but he used to come all the time. And in 2 years, I'd been in meetings with this man every week. He and I had never had a one-on-one. We never talked one-on-one. I'd heard him share. He'd heard me. We'd see each other. But he and I had never spoke to each other one-on-one. After picking my 2-year chip, he came to me and he said, you know, he said, it's so good to see you pick up your chip. And it's so good to hear you share. Because I got to tell you, and this man had 27, 20 years. And he said, I've been in this program a long time. And I've seen a lot of people come in and out of those doors. And when you came in, I thought you were too late. Too late for Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't hear that very often. We don't hear that very often. And the miracle is that we sit here today living inside this miracle. We have the chance. And there's so many people that don't get it. There's so many people that don't get it. I cannot tell you how much I love this program and believe that this program works. Because there are countless people that are out there today that are out there struggling with the same struggles that we have had. And for some of them, today will be too late. We will lose some of them today. We will lose some people as we go through these years of sobriety. You know, they will come in and they will go out. But if we stay in here, if we stay, this is the miracle. We are living inside of the Maricopa's program, Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's by the grace of God that brought me in here and that I can stand here today. And I'm very, very grateful for you asking me to come speak, and I hope everybody has a safe and happy holiday. Thank you very much.